Welcome to Volume 4 of Capital Ideas Live, a live teleconference on the breaking issues of forestry today in Alabama and throughout the nation. This 30-minute live teleconference is brought to you by the Alabama Forest Owners Association. You can learn more about the association and our guests by visiting our website, www.alabamaforestowners.com. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Association. I'll be your host for this teleconference. And in today's volume, we'll discuss an issue that's on the November 7th ballot that will affect every Alabamian. We'll also discuss the recalculation of your current use property tax bill. We'll talk about the different ways to harvest timber and the work currently going on in Washington to promote tax fairness. We'll take a look back at how our forests looked in ancient times. We'll look at regeneration, aerial photography, new products for the forest manager in your household, and finally, we'll talk about the stumpage market. Let's begin with a discussion of an issue that we'll face on November 7th. Timber is a renewable resource, but one resource that's not renewable is oil and gas. What to do with the money derived from the oil and gas royalties that are owned by the people of the state is a topic of a lot of debate. We're joined by Reagan Ingram, Communication Director for Lieutenant Governor Steve Windham, who is urging a no vote on Amendment 1. On November 7th, the ballot will include a proposal to change how the money derived from the state's oil and gas revenue will be spent. Reagan, I wanted to ask you how Amendment 1 would change the way that this $2 billion is being spent.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to be on today. Currently, the state is receiving about $100 million a year in royalties from the oil and gas companies in the form of royalties to the trust funds. Over the past 20 years, we've created two funds, the Alabama Trust Fund, or the Alabama Heritage Trust Fund in 82, and then the Alabama Trust Fund in 85. By law, they'll merge next year and be worth about $2 billion. Every dime has gone in except for monies that were set aside for Forever Wild and for cities and counties. The money has stayed in the fund with interest income only coming out to the general fund. That's what we do now.
Okay, how will that change?
Well, Amendment 1 purports to divert 35% straight off the top to finance a variety of bond issues for road and bridge program, docks improvements, the bond issues that the voters approved in 1998, and it wants to use capital gains to replace the interest money that has been going to the general fund by capturing 75% of realized and unrealized capital gains. That's so what the legislation says.
So it sounds like 35%, is that of the principal, is coming off
well,
the top?
Well, that 35% of what would be principal is stopped immediately.
Okay.
And we're talking about a non-renewable resource, as you said. It's going to play out probably in about 20 to 25 years. You can, you know, get all sorts of expert opinion on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the things that you mentioned that would be funded by the programs are roads and bridges, and I think that considered in the proposal is also a new forestry building for the School of Forestry at Auburn, which we do need. In the Lieutenant Governor's judgment, are these appropriate uses for this oil money?
Well, everybody, I don't know of a person that doesn't want the projects. We're very much in favor of the projects. The problem is that we have legislation that is fatally flawed. What we would like to do is to come back in the regular session and clean up the language of this amendment to protect the principle of the trust, where all the money continues to go in to grow the trust, and to tighten up the definition of capital gains to where we can finance these bond issues to do these things. And also, one thing that's not really been mentioned too much publicly, but we have a $60 million surplus at the end of the fiscal year today. That could clearly start the bond issues that would take care of the forestry building and for the ag bond issue and the forensics bond issue that are so desperately needed. We can also, we have the time to measure this thing twice before we start sawing into the trust fund. We want to keep growing the principal, protect the principal at all costs, and then find a way to maximize capital gains use and interest use so we can pay for these projects and continue to send money to the general fund.
Okay. Well, thank you for that perspective on Amendment 1 that will be on the ballot on November 7th.
Okay. Glad to join you.
All right. While we're visiting with our friends in Montgomery, we wanted also to chat with Alan Elrod, who's with the Alabama Department of Revenue. Alan is involved in recalculating the numbers which determine your property tax bill, that is, if you elect current use. Now, current use is a way of valuing your forest land, and it determines how much you're going to pay each year in property tax. If you elect current use for timber, this means that your land will be valued by a formula, and this formula has as one of its components timber price. And as we all know, timber prices don't stay the same, so periodically the Department of Revenue updates its information and generates new numbers. Alan, you're in the process of revisiting those timber price numbers now. First, can you tell me where you get that information on timber prices?
Certainly, Hayes. I appreciate the opportunity to participate this morning and kind of let folks know how we go about this process. Statutorily, we are required each year to revisit current use and update all of the data that goes into the current use valuation and evaluate it. And it's quite a complicated process for agricultural properties and forest properties. So we won't get into the agricultural side of it, but just very briefly on forest property, timberlands, each calendar year immediately preceding October the 1st, we start gathering the data. And we get the average pulpwood price per cord from the Alabama Forestry Commission. We take
take those numbers from the Forestry Commission?
Yes, we take those numbers from the Forestry Commission. Takes out the expenses for ownership and management.
Mm-hmm.
And basically that is a percentage that is set by code, a 15% that they allow for ownership and management expenses. We take that out of there and come to an imputed net income per acre. Now, once we get to that net income per acre, then we capitalize that. The capitalization rate comes from a federal land bank,
mm-hmm.
and we use the 10 most recent calendar years and take an average of those. And once we have that average interest rate that is acquired from the federal land bank, then the statute requires us to reduce that by 4.5%.
Tell us what you're generally finding on the realm of timber prices that you've gotten from the Forestry Commission. What is the trend there and what you're seeing?
Well, it has, over the past 10 years, we've had a slight trend up each year, somewhere around from 5, 6%, it appears. I don't have those actual figures right in front of me on a year-to-year basis for,
mm-hmm.
for those. What I'm looking at here is pretty much what we did last year as opposed to this year.
A slight trend line upward.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is the actual current use value that's placed is again capped by a 3% per year increase for each calendar year since 1981 is the maximum amount
mm-hmm.
that timber prices can increase or current use values can increase. To give you an example,
let me ask you this: how often do y'all revisit these numbers?
Every year, statutorily, we're required to do it every year.
Okay. All right. Great, Alan. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate your perspective from Montgomery and looking at those prices for us. Our next guest is Bruce Eason, who's president of Piedmont Foresters in Lafayette, Alabama. He's regularly involved in helping his clients sell wood. Bruce, there's traditionally been two ways to sell wood. Can you tell us about those two methods?
Yes, Hayes. I appreciate the opportunity to participate this morning. Sales of standing timber will fall into one of two basic types. It'll either be a lump sum or a per unit sale. with the lump sum sale, the wise timberland owner determines before he sells the volume of timber being sold and the fair market value of the timber. He then solicits bids from prospective buyers, and he will sell that timber to the highest bidder if that bidder offers the preset minimum acceptable bid or better.
Okay, that's the lump sum, and what is the other way of doing it?
The other method is the per-unit sale, and it's also called pay as cut. With this method, payment is made on an agreed price per unit, which will be either cords, tons, or 1,000 board feet, and is made in installments as the cutting progresses.
Okay. Now, if you look at these two methods, what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of selling timber these ways?
The pay-as-cut method works very well and is advantageous if the volume of timber being sold is very small or where unusual problems exist that would adversely affect the lump sum sale.
Okay, that's some advantage and disadvantage of pay-as-cut. What about the lump sum?
Okay, the advantages of the lump sum are that the seller will receive full payment for his timber up front. The buyer takes immediate title to the timber, thus assuming all risk of loss during the term of the contract. And the lump sum sale will almost always, without fail, result in receiving the very best price.
Okay. Yeah, are there ways of having competition come to play in both of these methods? In other words, can you have bids on both a lump sum and a pay-as-you-cut?
Yes, Hayes, you can take bids with both methods. With the pay-as-cut, you would have bidders make an offer on a per-unit basis, either by cord, tons, or 1,000 board feet. And with the lump sum sale, you could do the same. You would send out invitations to bid on the timber and take bids as well.
Okay. What implications are there in using these two methods beyond what you've already mentioned?
A very important implication is the tax treatment that's presently allowed by the IRS with respect to these methods of selling timber. Very, very important implication here. And I think that our next guest is going to give us some very useful information on this, and I look forward to his discussion.
Okay. Well, all right. We appreciate that. Thank you for that perspective. I'm Bruce Eason. Our next guest is going to help us shed some light on the current state of the tax code for some timber sellers who sell timber. We're happy to have Charlie Tarver with us. Charlie is president of Forest Investment Associates, and he's a graduate of Auburn University School of Forestry. But the special reason that we wanted to have Charlie join us today is because he is chairman of the Forest Landowners Tax Council. Charlie, this discussion we're having about lump sum or by the unit sale has some tax implications for some landowners, especially those who sell frequently, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Hayes. The landowners that find themselves in a situation where they're selling timber on a regular basis are really forced to look at the tax code a little differently from those that just sell on a maybe every 20-year basis. And what the Forest Landowners Tax Council is trying to do is to eliminate the disadvantage that's caused by that part of the code for timber sellers, those who sell on a regular basis. First, just a little bit about the Tax Council, which is a nonprofit national organization based in Washington, D.C., that represents the interest of non-industrial private timberland owners on matters of federal timber taxation. Some of the tax issues that the Tax Council is currently working on include Section 631B, which applies to this issue of lump sum versus unit sales that we were talking about earlier. We also are working very hard on the state tax or death tax issue, the reforestation tax credit, and passive loss rules. And for listeners that might want to learn more about those issues and the Tax Council, they can go to the website at www.fltc.org. Now, getting back to the issue of lump sum versus per unit sales, I think it would be fair to add that one of the most significant disadvantages of the per unit sale is the process for measuring or weighing or determining just how much timber leaves the seller's property. When you sell on a lump sum basis, you can determine and reach agreement up front on how much timber is sold and get all of the money up front. On a per unit sale, it typically has to be measured in some way as it leaves or after it leaves the property, and that's just one of the many disadvantages to the seller. But getting back to Section 631B of the tax code, because of this section, forest landowners are often forced to choose between really the best method to sell and the best tax treatment. In most cases, I think most foresters would agree that the lump sum sale is best. And as was previously pointed out, though, there are times when the per unit method is best. But regardless of that, frequent sellers of timber have to choose between the best method of selling their timber and the best tax treatment. And as we all know, good forest management and good business practices should dictate how landowners sell their timber.
All right. Well, instead of in doing it because the tax code says a certain thing about it, what would the Forest Landowners Tax Council like to see in terms of changes made to the law?
Well, we have actually had specific legislation introduced last year. In fact, unfortunately, it was among tax legislation vetoed by President Clinton. And what our legislation would have done would remove a specific requirement within Section 631B, and that is the requirement that the landowner retain an economic interest in the timber during the contract period. This is a very, very onerous provision that means essentially that throughout the contract period, whether it's 1 year or 2 years or whatever, the landowner must bear all the risk of loss to that timber during the period, whether it's from disease, fire, wind, or whatever. And that's just one of the many disadvantages of that section of the code. But our legislation would have removed that disadvantage and would, in effect, allow frequent sellers of timber to sell on a lump sum basis and still get capital gains treatment.
All right.
Now, for the timber frequent timber seller that sells on a lump sum basis and on a regular basis, they run the risk of being denied capital gains treatment.
All right. And you'd like to see that changed?
Okay. Yes. We're working very hard to see that changed.
All right. Well, thank you for that forward-looking perspective and for your work with the Forest Landowners Tax Council.
Thank you, Hayes. I appreciate being here today.
Okay. Our next guest, Tom Bonnickson, can discuss the idea that, you know, by looking over your shoulder in history, one can gain a new perspective on the future. Dr. Bonnickson, we're glad to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
Good. Dr. Bonnickson is a professor of forest restoration and environmental decision making at Texas A&M, and he's written a book called America's Ancient Forests: From the Ice Age to the Age of Discovery. He's a forestry teacher who offers a historical perspective in land management. Dr. Bonnickson, I got the impression from the popular press that when European explorers found this forest in the United States, it was in a completely static state, in complete equilibrium. Is that a true picture of what those early explorers found?
Well, it certainly wasn't in a static state, and the equilibrium that existed was one that existed with human use. And so the equilibrium was really a managed equilibrium.
Hmm. So there's always been a use of the forest, even in times of European exploration?
Absolutely. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book, probably the first reason, was because I wanted to document the incredible natural heritage that we have in our forests in North America. But a couple of other reasons were this idea, really a myth, that our forests were virtually untouched when the explorers arrived. And so part of what I did was document the role that Native Americans played from the arrival of Paleo-Indians and modern Indians in the development and maintenance of our forests.
What were some of the uses that those early inhabitants of North America found for the forest?
Well, they actually found many uses that are similar to the ones we find. Not surprisingly, they needed wood. And many of the large cities and villages in the east, for example, were constructed with large amounts of wood, which meant they actually harvested trees. And they used trees for all the other purposes that you would think, you know, nuts and so forth. But they also burned forest, as many people know, to keep them open and also to favor the trees that were most useful to them.
All right.
And in fact, I've documented something like 70 different reasons why they used fire.
All right. Well, that's a perspective we don't often hear, and if you're interested in Dr. Bonnickson's book, America's Ancient Forests, from the Ice Age to the Age of Discovery, you can find a link on the Forest Owners Association webpage. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Bonnickson.
You're welcome.
Well, to help us with the idea of what uses we can make of our forest, our next guest is Michelle Eisenberg. She's a forest product specialist with BASF, formerly American Cyanamid. She's familiar with site preparation prior to replanting and has helped a number of people make choices in regeneration. Michelle, when landowners harvest, they're given all sorts of advice on site preparation from their consultants, their neighbors, and the guy at the coffee shop. Can you narrow down what choices a landowner faces in site preparation prior to planting?
Sure, Hayes, and thank you for allowing me to speak. When they're looking at cutting their track and then moving into site preparation, there's several different areas they need to look at. And the way that you need to look at those is ultimately what is the objectives of that landowner. So that will come into big time play when assessing what they're going to do for site preparation to get their trees into the ground. So what they can look at to get their trees in the ground is one thing that they can do is they can look at a chemical site preparation with different types of herbicides out there to get control of species that will ultimately impact their trees once they have them in the ground. They also have to look at, is fire needed on those sites? You know, how accessible are those sites going to be for planters to come in and plant? Another factor that will go into that is mechanical work. Do those sites need to be bedded? Do they need to be ripped? So those are some of the factors that they need to look at. They need to individually assess those sites with their management plan in mind. What are they going to be managing for? Are they managing for recreation, for wildlife, for aesthetics, for income? Because all of that will ultimately impact how they go out and site prepare their sites.
You mentioned three things that they need to keep in mind. Chemical site preparation, is fire needed, and mechanical site prep. It's October when this teleconference is being held. What should landowners who have harvested be thinking about right now?
Okay, landowners right now should be thinking about, A, just like what you said, chemical site preparation. If they got their site chemically prepared, most likely they were going to have a burn after that chemical site prep. Now the next step is they're going to be looking at their trees going into the ground. If the landowner did not do a chemical site preparation because the helicopter didn't have an opportunity to get there or they didn't have that lined up ahead of time to do, they need to look at preparing that site with mechanical methods, be it bedding or ripping, with a fire in front of that to get access for the planters to be able to come into those areas and plant. So really, they should have, if they were going to do a chemical site preparation, that should have been in the plans ahead of time several months ago. So now they have to look at what does that site specifically need in order to get the trees in the ground. And that's where the advice of an expert can come in and say, okay, you were unable to use a herbicide on that site, but let's look at a fire, let's look at bedding, let's look at ripping. So there's going to be several factors or several opportunities that they still have to get that site prepared to bring the trees into the ground to basically enhance the survival of the trees.
All right. Well, thank you, Michelle, for joining us.
Thank you, Hayes.
Glenn Dabney is with us also. He's from Monticello, Arkansas. Glenn is a consultant forester with Kingwood Forestry Services, and he's a pilot who assists in providing custom aerial photography to landowners. Glenn, when a landowner orders aerial photographs, there are really many different types for different purposes, aren't there?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the different types and what uses you might make of those?
Well, I guess the primary thing when you talk about different types, what I think about is photograph scale. And we take photographs in a whole bunch of different scales, and the use of the photograph is what determines what scale we'll photograph the site at. For most applications, the clients that we've done photographs in AFOA, we've done photographs at fairly small scales, say 4 inches equal a mile or 1 inch equal 1,320 feet. But if a client has an area, as the previous speaker was talking about, where a herbicide application is to be performed, or the area has been clear cut and they're looking to find out how many acres are in the site, larger scale photographs might be appropriate.
Okay, so scale is one thing to consider. What about how the photograph looks?
The I guess when you talk about looks, are you referencing maybe color versus
sure.
black and white?
Color, black and white. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess a lot of that has to do with the way the landowner is going to use the photograph too. If they're going to use the photograph for forest management, where they need to be able to differentiate between pine trees and hardwood trees, color is generally speaking taken during the wintertime. Is going to work best for that landowner. It's going to be easier for them to interpret the photograph and understand what they're seeing. If, for example, the area that is the subject of the photograph is an area that it's been infested with, say, southern pine beetle or has been a burned area, a color infrared photograph might be appropriate. Color infrared is more difficult for the average landowner to interpret, but it does show more information with respect to bugs and insects, disease, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like all aerial photographs are not created equal. They're different ones for different purposes.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, thank you, Glenn, for joining us with that perspective. We're next joined by Keith Polk. Keith, we've got a minute or so for you to tell us about some Christmas gifts for that person who'd rather be in the woods than anywhere else. Keith is with Forestry Suppliers in Jackson, Mississippi. What products are y'all offering that might be of interest to some folks?
Hayes, we got a holiday brochure that's just come out. We'll be mailing here shortly. And we've got a little bit of everything in there. Most of all, what I think your landowners would be tickled to death to get a hold of is a MapTech Terrain Navigator CD-ROM.
So is that a topographic map?
They are. It's topographical maps, basically your USGS type map with a 1 to 24, 1 to 25,000, and a 1 to 100,000 scale.
Does that cover Alabama also?
It most certainly does. You can, Alabama or someone interested in the state of Alabama can acquire that for around $100, $99.95.
Okay, so that's a CD-ROM. Is that compatible with a GPS unit that landowners might have?
Most definitely. It's compatible with most GPS units that are capable of downloading to a computer or desktop or laptop computer. We found that a good unit to join that with is a Garmin 12 or 12XL.
All right. Well, I think we've got a link to some of those products on the website. Keith, we thank you for joining us and offering that advice.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Our final guest is Pete Stewart, who's president and CEO of ForestToMarkets.com. His company has developed an Internet application that can give us up-to-date pricing information. Pete, timber prices fluctuate very quickly. Can you tell us what you're working on that might affect how decisions are made in buying and selling timber?
Yes, what we're working on here is a timber price reporting service that's reported at a county level and higher. In other words, you can get local market information, and it is no more than 5 days delayed after the sale takes place. So the landowner can come in and actually see what real-time timber price in his area is doing, and it's no more than 5 days old right at his desktop.
How far along are you on this project, and how can someone, for example, subscribe to the service?
Yes, we have had our service up for 2.5 months. We have data coverage in about 7 of the southern states, including Alabama. We are shooting for all the southern states. We have about 25 large reporters, meaning forest products companies and regional consultants. We're continually growing our database through more and more consultants. So all the landowner has to do is come in, onto the site. There's a spot you can register. You register as a landowner. It costs you $34.99 a year. And you just choose which county that you have land in, and we automatically put you in one of the 39 market areas that we have designated in the South as how wood generally moves and markets move, and you get information about that market area right at your desktop. In addition to that, you get some other features, such as a way to track your asset value of your timberland, ways to get industry news, and ways to contact forestry service providers and timber buyers.
All right. Well, that sounds like a great project, and we look forward to that developing. And we have a link to you on the website. Thank you, Pete.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the time that we have for today's teleconference. Be sure to join us on November 15th at 10 o'clock Central for Volume 5 of Capital Ideas Live. Our thanks go to Reagan Ingram, to Alan Elrod, and Bruce Eason, Charlie Tarver. We appreciate having comments from Tom Bonickson, Michelle Eisenberg, Glenn Dabney, and our thanks go to Keith Polk and Pete Stewart. Thanks for joining us, the Alabama Forest Owners Association, for Capital Ideas Live, as we bring you the latest news in forestry.